sit here and just contemplate the desire to ask a question.
I think one of the most dangerous things is righteous indignation.
Yes,
one really is right.
That's when it's really dangerous. Now, I had a lot of that. I used to get so righteous in my nature. Can get very indignant. And I think, you know, outraged. So this would always lead to usually a worsening of a situation. And it's so convincing because you are right in a way. And this was where Lungpo Cha would have, in Thai language, he'd give her this reflection which translates right but not true, true but not right. And because people can say something that's right, it's not necessarily true, or true but not necessarily right. And this is a good reflection because we oftentimes believe, grasp hold of our sense of being right, or being what we're defending the truth, but we're not aware of our own anger and our own the results of our anger and indignation oftentimes really harms what we're trying to protect. So that's why when we're mindful, then we're bringing into consciousness time, place, our own state of mind. Like if I'm angry, if I feel anger, and I start telling you something, what I'm saying might be very good and true, but what you're picking up is my anger. So then you think Ajahn Sumedho was angry with me. I might be telling you very, really good things you should be doing, but you can't hear that because you're too affected by the anger that I'm sending toward you. So that this is like right but not true, true but not right. Yes.
I find myself wondering, if people don't have that kind of spark and ambition, which is a form of love, perhaps, what happens to creativity and what needs to be creativity?
Well, that's an interesting question because creativity is something that we give a lot of importance to in the West. And like we have the creation myths, and the idea of creation, being creative, is a very important value for us. And also we can see if creativity is just coming out of ignorance, wanting to get, maybe for egotistical reasons, get what you want, or get your own way, or become famous, or that kind of thing. Then, of course, even though people might have a tremendous talent and artistic abilities, it tends to, it doesn't come from an empty mind, but from a lot of desires and a lot of prejudices and biased views. So I was very interesting. I watched my sister change over the years. She's an artist, and she's 2 years older than I am. She's always, as a child, very artistic, like in painting and drawing, and she's explored the art world from many different angles, from craft to jewelry. She used to be a jewelry designer, and then into painting landscapes, and now she's painting icons in the Byzantine style. And I was with her just last month in America, and she's 63 years old. And now she's explaining, she's learning how she's become a third order Carmelite, and it's a lay person's position, but she's quite a strongly religious woman, and in a Roman Catholic, and so she's in this third order Carmelite. Then she goes to expressing her spirit, her artistic abilities through a very kind of traditional and conservative art form, and it's interesting at towards the end of her life that she should put herself in such narrow confines, that she's explaining how narrow and stylized and traditional icon painting is, and there's no room for a kind of personal interpretation or creativity. And yet she's finding that kind of as a meditation, something very is bringing up all her a lot of things that she's, you know, that have caused her a lot of pain over the years. And her faith in this is, and so much she's using it as a meditation, almost like me being a monk, you know, where you're actually containing yourself in a very traditional, very formal way. And then she's doing it in her art, with her art, through using a very conservative and old art form. But she's also she's not just kind of doing it as a just to kind of make herself into an icon artist, but as a meditation, because the narrowness of the form and the stylization of it and all the rules that go along with it somehow reflect something in her, that, you know, the kind of wildness or her own personality. And she sees more and more how to relinquish, more a sense of relinquishment. Well, it is. It's, you know, but it's exciting, and it's and it's very, very compelling. But also, I mean, but also in that, you also, I mean, you have to maybe go through things to find out. You know, you have to. We all learn from experience, and I mean, you can say, you know, you can give people a lot of sage advice, but I think we've all had to learn usually the hard way. I have. All the good advice I had, I still managed to have to learn through my own experience, oftentimes my own dismal failures or disappointments. But here I find I think something that sometimes it's not mentioned very much in Buddhism, or especially in Theravada Buddhism, where the experience of suffering is emphasized so much, where you emphasize dukkha and suffering. But I also find, as an experience, that once you let go of those of the causes of suffering, then you begin to relate to the beauty of life in a very joyful way, because you're open to it. You're not looking at it in a desire to own it or to change it or with a critical mind of how to improve it. But you find a joyfulness or a sense of delight with the beauty that you see in other people or in nature, because then your mind isn't cluttered with selfish desires to possess, or jealousy, or with envy, or just insensitive experience where you can just be in the most beautiful place but not really notice it, not see it, because of what's going on in your head. But as that kind of karma is resolved, then the pure mind is receptive. So you have this mudita, or this sense of joyfulness at the beauty. And I found also, just like with say jealousy, where I found, you know, that this is a problem that I've had to deal with, because in a competitive society, when you're brought up to compete all the time with others, jealousy is such a powerful emotion, because you're always comparing yourself with somebody else, and so then you see somebody else's talent or beauty or whatever in a critical way, as a threat to you, and so you can't delight or find joy in beauty of others, because you're always thinking of yourself first. The sense of yourself blinds you to that, and as that self drops away, that sense of yourself, then that also is a natural experience, natural way of relating. Because we do live in a planet like here in England, a very beautiful country. So for much of my life here, I'm surrounded by very beautiful things, nature, and really lovely people that I live with. So, I mean, these are, these can be not noticed if you're caught in your own kind of negative scenarios. But once you drop that, then you're quite receptive, because if there's no self, then you see the beauty around you is belonging to everything. It's not seen in the kind of divisive perceptions of me and you and all that implies, and emotional habits that come from that perception. Like me and you sets up this huge division. Certainly like to help and hear the news about Bosnia. it's so easy to get cynical about human nature because you hear so many horrible things about what people do, but also, I mean, the thing is that if that gives this whole negative tendency, you're empowering it all the time by believing it. So when we, you know, and also I see how divisive it is to take sides. Have a tendency towards righteousness. How easy it is for me to feel compassion in for the victims, and the victimizers just feel outraged and want to, you know, just feel no compassion for them. And this is also a very divisive tendency. Because there's no end to it. I mean, you know, if you start just, no matter how bad somebody is to somebody else, when you really come right down to it, they're the worst one. I mean, they're the ones that are going to suffer the most. I'd rather be a victim than I'd rather be killed than kill. I'd rather be tortured than torture somebody, knowing what I know, because I couldn't bear the mind, the guilt, and the self-hatred that would come from having to remember, having deliberately caused pain and destroyed somebody's life or maimed them with that. Because even though we can think people might be getting away with these atrocities, they're not. And people pay a high, you know, they usually have to turn to drink or suicide or something because of the heavy karma of torturing somebody or raping somebody or abusing in any way, verbally or physically, or killing anyone. I do feel I've been in this country about 19 years now, so I've noticed, you know, even though it's not, you know, not majority or in terms of the population of this country, you know, it's not a high percentage in terms of the population, but in terms of growth and interest, there's a noticeable changing of people moving toward a much more awakened, realizing that they have to awaken up within themselves. They just can't expect life to be laid on for them, or magicians to come and change them into happy people forever, or psychiatrists to solve all their problems, or the Tories or the Labour Party to set everything right for us. I mean, we realize we've been through enough already to realize that there is something we have to do, and many more people aware of this. And then also you realize with mindfulness, when you're letting go of the conditioning and you're not attached, that pure state of awareness is universal. So, I mean, it's not a separative, it's not like in my head or mine, as if, you know, I have it and you don't, or that somehow my mindfulness is different from yours. It's not like that. What we're mindful of is infinitely variable, but that pure awareness is universal. So, I mean, that's something to trust in, that is influencing everything too. The purity of your heart, it has a powerful effect on everything, even though on the emotional level you might feel it's not doing anything. You know, in terms of quantities and able to see, you know, obvious results, you might not notice, but in terms of the what you're tuning into is a universal wisdom that's affecting all of us, whether we're aware of it or not. And so that's why it isn't, the religious path is an act of faith, because we trust, we become more trusting. in just being in non-attachment, in just being mindful, without expecting any kind of proofs, or, you know, we're not on a personal level demanding anything from anyone, that anything be proven, or that we see any noticeable results in our lifetime. What we know, this is what we can do that is right and for the benefit of all beings. So that's what we can do. And then sometimes we might be called upon to take an active part in some way in the organization or conferences, or be an advisor to the Prime Minister, or have a powerful influence on the Bosnian Serbs through some kind of, because somebody's daughter happened to take a course, Vipassana course, and who knows? Who knows what strange things might happen? But anyway, it's of no value to promote the negative view of life. Because that's, everybody is very much, that affects so much how we see things. And that's what you're getting so much in the popular media, you know, in the newspapers and the television. There's so much emphasis on the horridness of humanity, or the weakness, or the corruptibility of humanity. And because that's quite exciting and dramatic. The goodness is not exciting to most people. Like, I remember they were going to Robert Bolt, the playwright. You know, he wrote a film about the life of the Buddha, and they were going to Bertolucci. You know, made the film. Called the Little Buddha, but before that was made, they asked Robert Bolt to write the script, and he lives near Chithurst, you see, in Sussex. So he was telling the monks, he said, you know, it's very difficult to write a good dramatic cinema about somebody that was born good and got better. And that's the most difficult challenge he'd had, and they didn't take it, you know. Well, this is where we with non-attachment, and that is something to not make it into a kind of some, you know, grasping the idea of it all the time, and then making your life into a where you feel you're always in some very frustrating situation. Because on the ideal level, on the more kind of ideal level, you can't live up to such the high standards that you can imagine, or you subscribe to as ideas. And so this is where with mindfulness we're more aware of the time, the place, the people, the situation we're in. We're noticing how things affect us, not just coming from a very idyllic place, but beginning to recognize if we can work, if we're in an organization or with a group that we have to be with, I mean, somehow if we can't leave them or we have to be with these people, then then just to always compare them to the ideal, we just feel this kind of aversion and frustration with it, with them. So it's, you know, to recognize that, and to recognize sometimes we're expecting too much from our, and we're demanding too much from the world, from the society, the people that we're living, and also from ourselves in terms of being able to conceive the best and not being able to sustain a life around being the very best. So this is humbling for us. And so we think, how can we work with what we have and with mindfully and for the benefit of all of the beings concerned? And that's the challenge. Because I'm just going to leave this and leave it behind. I'm not going to have anything more to do with those people because they're not good enough. I can understand that. But sometimes that is just, you know, lacking in compassion. We don't care enough to try to maybe work in a way that is, that we can kind of raise them up a little bit more than, or help them, or at least have some kind of good influence on their lives. That maybe not in the dramatic and miraculous ways that we'd like, but in ways that would be of help to them and to the organization. So it's like I can see in a monastery how you can how easy it is to feel sometimes a sense of frustration or despair and with the members of the community, and you can imagine having kind of cream of the crop monks and nuns that fulfill all your ideals, but then these are the people I'm living with, the way they are, what they are, and all their problems and their tendencies and their warts and I have to accept that. I work with that. This is my family, and so I work with that rather than thinking that there's some possibility of setting myself up with kind of ideal people that wouldn't have all these failings. But I've never seen that where that exists. Life is like this. It's learning to put up with what you think you can't bear. Learning to respond to things that are, and how to say let go of just being negative and irritated and exasperated by the experiences that you might have to endure. Does that help? No, I wouldn't make a problem about it. I just be as clear as you can and see what happens. Because you don't know also the other forces affecting a situation. You might see it in one angle, but not see it, know all the other things affecting it. So sometimes it's people that have a clarity and an honesty are greatly respected, and they're very essential for any organization. The last thing you want is a bunch of sycophants. I mean, that's a disaster. You need people who can reflect and can tell you, can admonish, tell you what's going wrong, or not as an endless, you know, harangue of criticism. But I mean, like in monastic life, you need feedback. You need to know when your actions are upsetting people, or when, or how you affect people, because, you know, oftentimes you can't see it till somebody tells you. And of course it is, in some ways, if you get a community of obsequious sycophants, you can get high on it, but in the long run it doesn't work, because nobody's willing to admit it's the emperor's new clothes. Nobody's willing to say, look, look here. You realize you're not wearing anything? You need people like that, or you say, and where they in the company person that goes along, they're, you know, they might seem like they're the ones that are appreciated, but they're not, that's not always, and oftentimes it's not even very healthy for the organization itself. Is there? Right. It's in fact, you know, the more mindful you are, the happier. You find joy in washing up, or things that before you thought were, you know, you were beneath you, or you just wanted to do in a perfunctory way, because you're not expecting anything. You're not looking forward to the next thing. You're willing to just be with and trust with the moment as it is, and whatever, with whoever you happen to be with, or whatever way you happen to be feeling, or whatever is happening. Just take like one step at a time practice, or And I use that as a way of reminding myself, you know, because the mind tends to be always looking on to the next thing. You know, if you're washing up, you're trying to get that over so you can go on to something else that you think is more worthy of your attention than the dishes or your, you know, I could see just how my mind is programmed to be doing something and then already looking on to what next, kind of quidnunc mentality, what's next, and then so you're never, even when you're doing with something very even enjoyable, the mind will start thinking about what you're going to do after. You know, I noticed this, that even things that I would be finding pleasant, the mind was so conditioned to think about what's next and almost doing things in order to get them over to go on to the next thing. And so one never really could enjoy just being with the people, with the situation, with the way it is, even when it's an enjoyable scene. But as you see, let go of that following of desire and that whole kind of movement of restless activity, doing this to finish it in order to go on to the next thing, then even most kind of banal, mundane kind of experiences are seen in a different way, you know, in a gentle and peaceful way. And then you do things much more, much better too, because you're not in that state of just trying to get something finished to get on to the next one. Good one. Then. Now I know there's a photograph of a water buffalo with a little boy lying on the back of it. I used to, you know, I remember, you know, 20 years ago or so, Buddhists used to say, like Thai or Sri Lankan people would say to me, why are Buddhist countries always so poor? You know, look at the Arabs, they're rich, they've got so much money. The Muslims, they got so much, rolling in money all the time. They got oil and... But the Buddhists, they're all poor. They say, is Buddhism just, you know, they kind of doubt with Buddhism some kind of, you know, it's a religion that just, you know, keeps you in a state where you can't make any money. This is what they were thinking. And they saw, you know, their own countries as backward and poor. But now, over the past 20 years, all these kind of Buddhist countries have become these kind of miracle economies in Asia, like South Korea and Japan and Hong Kong and Taiwan and Singapore and, you know, Malaya now. I was in the Peace Corps 30 years ago. I was in the Peace Corps in Malaysia. And Malaysia was then was a third world country, you know, and it was it looked third world and it seemed third world. But then I was there a couple of years ago in Kuala Lumpur, and an incredibly modern, up to date, sparkling city. Is anything but third world. In Singapore, I remember back in 1964 was just a kind of fading colonial, ex-colonial city it was a lot of slums in it and things, and then it was transformed into this kind of modern sanitary metropolis. And so then you get, now in Taiwan, you get organizations, the Chinese become so rich that they're publishing, they're seeking, they come and they write us, wanting us to send books for them to print for free distribution by the thousands. And last year they sent us a whole lorry load of these Dhammapada books, the big, thick Dhammapada, with illustrations and commentaries and everything included in it for free distribution. The book would cost about £50, I'm sure. But they were printing it to be given out to anyone. And they've got so much money that they've become very philanthropic. So, I mean, whether this is due to Buddhism or greed or what, I don't know. But it's not Buddhist. But I definitely feel that, I mean, I've seen a lot living here in Britain, where you've got a tremendous kind of religious tolerance. There's a, you know, and where there's so many the different religions living side by side, and where the kind of national religion, the C of E, is a quite tolerant group, you know, and have not been any kind of obstructive cause of any great obstructions to, say, Buddhists, that, from my experience. And also, there's a tremendous interest in interfaith and in trying to understand, not just on being culturally interested and nicely tolerant, but there's a much, you can see in the mystical forms of religious experience that coming together, that people are seeing that the differences oftentimes on their level of convention are not the important issues, and you know, it's not that they're, I mean, they're just different, but the goal, the ultimate mystical union or the realization of truth or whatever terms you choose to put it in is what religion's aiming at, and that for maybe the next century, hopefully, religions won't see themselves in terms of just converting and grasping people and dividing and trying to, you know, put down others to build themselves up. That whole way of thinking now seems so like such a defilement and such a kind of evilness to use something, to use a convention that's pointing towards a universal reality, but only use it to divide and separate and cause problems. And I think there's more awareness of this now, even on the levels of very, especially in the through meditation and through the more mystical forms that are being sought after now, where say in so much of the religious kind of conventions have been petrified in doctrinal kind of, not in the mystical union or the realization of ultimate truth, but in very fixed views of doctrinal principles. Those, of course, are variable and change, and whether you perceive God in terms of a human form or a abstract or whatever. I mean, the point is you're aiming beyond the symbol itself. Your attention, the symbol, is there to focus on to get beyond it. You know, so because in mindfulness, you know, like my sister's icons or the Buddha images here, you know, when you're talking about this, my sister and I were talking about the use of a Buddha image is the same as an icon, a Catholic icon, because you're focusing on the image itself to get beyond it, because it's, you know, like the Buddha image is just, you know, it's a marble image or a wooden image or whatever, but it's not meant to be worshipped as a thing in itself, but as an icon to focus, to get beyond to what's beyond the image or the conditioning, the particular conditions of or the conventions of a religion. And I have, in my experience with people who are truly on a religious path, is that there's a more, you know, a kind of a sense of we're together. We're not seeing each other totally in terms of the conventional conventions that we may be using. And I think that's a very good sign, because I've often felt, I can see just with Theravada Buddhism how, you know, how awful it can be to be so attached to just the idea of being a Theravadan Buddhist, because you can see so much kind of snobbery and prejudice against other forms of Buddhism by people who don't know anything about the other forms, you know. So you get people that are attached to views about Theravada and they really despise Mahayana, or Mahayana do that. They have all kinds of biases against Theravada that they're taught in their conventions, and so you get this you know. And then you have this morning I went to a dana at the Buddhist Light International Association in London, this Mahayana, Chinese Mahayana group in London. And they sponsored this, they called it a kind of Sangha Dana, where Mahayana, all the Buddhist monks and nuns from different schools were present, from Japan and Vietnam and Sri Lanka and Thailand and so forth. And then those features were given to convey the sense of brother and sisterhood and fellowship. And this goes on oftentimes on the external, but then when you get into the back room, they start telling you what they really think. I mean, I don't know about these people, but I mean, I've been in enough situations like that,
And I've seen even in the Theravada how you get this in different schools or different sects of Theravada. And so, and then I was brought up in the Episcopal Church in America, which is a very high church, high Anglican, and they were so divisive because they despised all the others. And so I was brought up in a family where they actually, you know, referred to Protestants as prots. And they were in a sign of contempt, you know, really contemptuous way. The prots. Yeah, you can say prot and it sounds pretty horrendous. And then, and that really, you know, I found that very disturbing. Experience to see the sectarian mind, but I'm also, I understand it, I understand how it works, but I've never wanted to promote it, I've always tried to, I mean, I could, I've sometimes out of just heedlessness, I might fall into maybe a few sectarian things, but that's not what I want to encourage or promote. Because I do see we need to, as human beings, aim at that which is universal, that which lifts us out of these conditioned views, ethnic views, cultural views, class or caste or racial or sexist or whatever, you know, whatever views that you might be holding, that with mindfulness we're actually transcending those views themselves. And that's what our refuge is in that, rather than in the Theravada Buddhism or High Church Anglicanism or whatever. Our refuge is in what is deathless and true, rather than in a particular convention we might actually prefer over another. I mean, why am I a Theravadan Buddhist monk? Because I like it. I prefer it. It is not saying in any way that it's better than anything else. It's just, this is what came along. This is what one inclined to, and this is the convention you've learned to use. Like playing in a musical instrument. You can't play them all. You've got to choose, develop. It doesn't mean that pianos are ultimately better than violins. Yeah, you have an orchestra. Yes, that's what I have hopes for. Because you can, we could make some beautiful music rather than the cacophonous noises. Really? Yeah. What is it they're going to have?
And they call it a spiritual component, whereas previously that area was never touched, never acknowledged. So that is a minute step.
It's a good sign.
But after what had happened in Chicago, because they did it, it seems that somewhere along the line that, I don't know how it could be done, but what you're saying is trying to offset all the differences to respect each other without trying to become undermined.
Now, I feel it very, that one doesn't want, I can't see everybody in the world adopting one religious convention. I mean, I just doesn't. Right?
I'm not going to wait for that to happen. In the time of the Buddha, you were getting kings and various aristocrats who were trying to, like King Ashoka was converted after seeing the horrors of battle and not wanting to have to kill anymore. But ethics also, people are realizing also that just making money without ethics is also very disastrous, and that ethical behavior is also something that needs to be regarded and given a very important place in our lives, so that how we do make our living it's in terms of Dhamma and in terms of honesty and moral integrity, and then that kind of thing has a tremendous power to develop a stable society and able to a society where we can trust and live together in a way without all the fear that comes when everyone's making up all their own rules and nobody knows, nobody agrees to even kind of moral foundation. Like now, one feels that everybody's just making up their own rules. There's no common agreements on, like the war, like in Bosnia. It's just slaughter, it's just anyone for themselves. There's no sense of the warrior or the ethics of battle. That's the idea of respect for the civilians or things like this. It's just rape, pillage, atrocity, murder, whatever, anything goes. And because the age is not educating us towards a sense of self-respect and personal integrity. It's now become taking individualism or like in the communist system. I don't know exactly what happened under the communists, but it didn't inculcate in their minds personal integrity. It seems it's
seems corruption and pettiness and that seemed to be the result of a tyrannical system. And this is one of the great gifts we have as human beings. We can agree on moral principles. We can decide we're not going to kill each other, even though we might feel like it sometimes, then we won't do it. Or we're not going to steal each other's things, even though we might feel the impulse to do so. We're making a determination not to do that. So this is, even though this is seems kind of ordinary and not anything special, it is quite a marvelous thing that we can agree to do that. You know, when you really think of it, that we can agree on certain ways of living with each other that provide a sense of security and trust, and we're not just living in the jungle or the, you know, in the battlefield, just having to, you know, mistrust and fear even the neighbor or the police or whoever. We have a society where there's a stable foundation of moral agreements, and that should be, you know, we need to think of it in international terms, in terms of the different of Islam and Christianity and Buddhism, Hindu, or atheists. We have to all agree to it. Whether, you know, you can be a total atheist, they're a communist, you can still agree on the moral level. It's not something that you have to join a religion for. And I think that's the beauty of our humanity. One of our great human gifts that is overlooked. And you feel that that's like in all these efforts to try to solve the problems in Yugoslavia, there's no kind of moral agreement at all. Just kind of power struggling and manipulation and intimidation. And so that's why nothing really takes. It's all just trying to outdo or intimidate or frighten or each other into submission in some way. So it's always a continuous humiliating thing that's going on to somebody. You know, it's not arousing what is noble and worthy of respect in the human mind. It's either, you know, humiliating one side or another by all these attempts to stop the war through just power, you know, pressure from superpowers and so threats to the people. Humans, we recognize, even though we're easily corrupted and we can be pretty awful, we actually love the good. And when somebody good arises, we tend to feel a sense of relief. And I think the Dalai Lama is, you know, for people now, has become a kind of figure, international figure, that everybody respects. And that he's, because he's good. And so, you know, you feel, and you're happy to have, you love the idea of the Dalai Lama. Because you want to see a human being who's actually incorruptible and good, but not self-righteous or not divisive. He's not a divisive kind of religious figure either. He's not promoting Tibetan Buddhism or Buddhism or anything at the expense of any other religion. So everybody, whether they're Buddhist or not, can kind of feel respect for him. No, we need more of it. I feel pretty lucky being a Buddhist that they have such an impressive kind of. It's become quite quite popular and fashionable. It appears in Vogue and has a coterie of film stars and whatnot chasing after him, and he gets publicity. But in himself, one feels that there's no conceit. You know, I met him many times and listened to him, and I've never felt, even though it. In his popularity and his fame, he's taking it in any personal way. He's not in danger of being ruined by the fashion world. I think he's more bemused by it. Yes, I'm sure having to be Dalai Lama would be a headache, you know, having to have such, be so special all the time. Right. I think you're right. You like the Chinese. That's one of the gifts that you get when you're a monk. It's a koala bear. I think somebody was in probably the duty free shop in Sydney and thought, what can I get Ajahn Sumedho? He's cute though, isn't he? Children, they make a beeline for it. Well, I think this is an age-old problem. but like non-attachment is like people sometimes don't realize how profound that is, because they, like many people, see non-attachment as indifference or not caring, or where we suffer a lot is where we want people to be what we want them to be, and then they aren't, and then we feel critical of them. Or like when teenagers, oftentimes they're rebelling and they're trying to break away from the kind of child relationship with the parents, and sometimes they've just become very obnoxious and that, and then we feel, you know, and we take it in a way that, you know, people can take it in a very personally and be very hurt by it, because we've not like them. I mean, we like them to respect us and have the kind of bonds that were there before, and then when it changes, we feel devastated. So this is where non-attachment allows us to reflect and learn to accept and to bear with, oftentimes, the changing conditions, which are not always going to be what we want, but which we have to bear it. There's nothing we can do about it. If we hate it and resent it, then we create a lot of misery in our minds. But we can learn from it. Mm-hmm. And so when the child that loves mom and then gets to the age where he doesn't want anything more to do with you or even be seen with you on the street. I mean, you can still use that for, you know, reflection. And these are stages. I notice when you get to about 40, then suddenly you realize, at least I did, I suddenly realized what my parents had to put up with. With me and my sister. I suddenly felt so grateful to them, you know. It took a while to really appreciate what, you know, how much parents give and how much they sacrifice and how little, you know, and how ungrateful one can be, because you're with them, you know, you don't understand until you're older what it, the difficulties of life. I remember at 18, 19, and I was so critical of my parents. You know, they didn't do this right, they didn't do that right, and I kept, I'm not going to do that, I'm going to make my life much better than theirs. The kind of conceit of youth. And then over the years, he realized, you know, what you know, the how difficult life is, and how much suffering you experience in it, and how much your parents must have suffered through your callousness, through my callousness, through my just not care, not noticing how my boorish behavior was affecting them. Because I was so centered on myself and my own desires. But, I think also my parents, I think they trusted in that, the fact they did give us a good foundation for life. And so after we got to a certain age, they more or less let us go without holding on, which I've always been grateful for, that I've never had parents who were trying to, you know, blackmail me, emotionally blackmail me or hold on to me, but trusted that they gave the best they could and then the rest is up to me, what I do with it is, and they weren't going to feel guilty or, or, you know, if I made a botch of it, it was, they weren't about to feel guilty for it, because they did have a confidence that they did the best they could. And then, as I grew older, I could see that they did. You know, I mean, really saw that they had to sacrifice. Sister and I were born in the Depression, in the '30s. Really hard time. My parents suffered a lot. They lost all their money in the '30s. They start all over again with two babies. And they went on, they got through it. Also, I realized that that generation just didn't, like, they didn't have the options and the alternatives that I've had, or my sister. I mean, they just, you know, that been born at the turn of the century, my parents, and they didn't have all the choices, options, opportunities for fulfilling their ambitions. They more or less had to take what they could get and do the best they could with it. Where, I mean, I remember having so, you know, I could choose, I would go to university, I had so many possibilities. And it's interesting now where you hear it's going, that isn't so much the case anymore. The present generation is, doesn't have many options either. And oftentimes they can't even get work once they finish their secondary education. They can't even find employment. And when I was, it wasn't, I couldn't find employment. I had trouble deciding which job I wanted.